Welcome to this podcast of KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, you'll hear an excerpt from a recent talk by University of Washington professor Relina Joseph. Joseph teaches in the UW's Department of Communication and is the founding director of the Center for Communication, Difference, and Equity. The title of her talk is What's the Difference with Difference? In it, she helps us weed through the complexities of words and sentiments with a view towards, ultimately, making a better world. We're presenting the main core of her talk here. If you'd like to hear the introduction by UW President Anamari Kause and the Q&A session, you'll find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Relina Joseph spoke at UW's Kane Hall on January 14th. Thanks to Yvette Moy for our recording.
Those of us who do social justice work are often cautioned and sometimes even admonished that we need to be mindful of not preaching to the choir. Noting such a sentiment, when Harry Belafonte gave the first talk of this Equity and Difference lecture series in October, he shared a quote of Dr. King's, "If I don't preach to the choir, then the choir might stop singing." I speak to you today invoking Mr. Belafonte's and Dr. King's spirit. Choirs need fortifying. So thank you to all the members of the choir who have come here tonight. I will most definitely be speaking to you. But also let me talk to those of you who aren't necessarily in the choir, who came here tonight at the urging of a friend or the lure of extra credit points. I see you. To all of you, please understand that not everyone should sing in the choir before they have dedicated themselves to listening, to studying, to training their voices. Some people are born tone deaf and ring flat. Those folks might actually never be destined to lead their voices publicly. Indeed, since they have not practiced the skill of listening, we might cringe to hear them sing. However, even if you aren't destined for the choir right now, with openness, exposure, and study, you can learn to appreciate the music. A note of guidance. Do not expect members of the choir to be your teachers. Some of us might relish the opportunity to teach you our long-developed, hard-fought skills, but others might just want you to listen, not just hear, but truly listen. And in that listening, you will learn how to provide the essential support the choir needs, and yes, perhaps eventually sing. But before we can sing or listen to the melody, let's hear the dissonance. Or rather, let's hear the difference. And no, I'm not saying the difference and dissonance are the same, but I do think that embracing difference means listening to cacophony in addition to harmony. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Tonight, I'm going to talk with you about this word difference, or as the title of my talk promises, what's the difference with difference? We need to carefully consider why and how and where we're using terms that tell us something about race, gender, class, sexuality, and disability, as the umbrella term difference does. But we don't just want to think about our terms in order to use the so-called right words. Those of us embroiled in diversity work are often confronted by anxious allies wanting to use the right words. Just tell me what to say. I don't want to get in trouble. African-American instead of black, a plural gender-neutral pronoun they instead of a singular gendered pronoun he or she, woman instead of girl, or difference instead of diversity. I bristle at this right word question as it seems to seek right words to cover wrong sentiments. And perhaps this isn't fair. Some folks really want to educate themselves to speak and act with honor and respect. But part of that education must be the recognition that minoritized people do not have the responsibility to provide the right words if interest in different people only goes as far as different words. For our language, which names identities, and for minoritized people, for whom such language has historically been given, not chosen, our language is our power. Indeed, even the word that I just used, minoritized, spotlights power relations in the construction of the so-called minority-majority divide. I didn't use the old term minority, as I'm not interested in identifying people according to their smaller numbers. I used an in-process as opposed to a static word to show that those in the group are not smaller in significance or even perhaps in many parts of our country fewer in number, but that they have been constructed as such. Let me give you a second example. In the introduction to the 1998 edition of her canonical 1985 book, Aren't I a Woman? Female Slaves in the Plantation South, historian Deborah Gray White explains one important change she would make between the different editions, a change in language denoting a change in power. White writes, "Were I to write Aren't I a Woman today, I would use the verb enslaved rather than the noun slave to implicate the inhumane actions of white people. The noun slave suggests a state of mind and being that is absolute and unmediated by an enslaver. And slave says more about what happened to black people without unwittingly describing the sum total of who they were. And slave forces us to remember that black men and women were Africans and African Americans before they were forced into slavery and had a new and denigrating identity assigned to them." The linguistic change from an all-encompassing noun to an acted-upon verb better captures the way in which the subject position slave only means anything relationally within a system of enslavement. Deborah Gray White's change in language illuminates a change in power. Linguistic changes happen concurrently with historical and political changes, but appropriate language and the absence of other action only helps cover, for example, racism, homophobia, misogyny. So let's listen to equity as we follow difference tonight. Indeed, we cannot have difference without equity. Or rather, to iterate difference without equity lays it bare to become co-opted, softened, and stripped of its ability to truly change relations of power. In my talk tonight, after providing you with some definitions, I will look at the difference equity matrix as a successor to the terms diversity, multiculturalism, or tolerance, difference in equity as part of the movement aiming to provide humanity to those of African descent, Black Lives Matter, as opposed to the indifference presented in the All Lives Matter retort. And I'll get into this more later, but I want to underscore the idea that Black Lives Matter is a movement, All Lives Matter is a retort. Lastly, thank you. I haven't even gotten to it yet. My last thing I'm going to talk about is how a group of young women of color here at the University of Washington have created a space of difference and equity. Like the move from to enslaved from slaved, minoritized from minority, Black Lives Matter from All Lives Matter, the move from diversity to difference and equity present a similar relationality and an opportunity to see power and ultimately create change. So to make sure that we're all on the same page, let me define our key words here. And first up is equity. While equality means that everyone gets the same resources, opportunity, access, equity means everyone gets what they need. Equity is distributive justice. A popular meme illustrates that equity amounts to fairness while equality amounts to sameness. One organization puts it this way: equity is the means, equality is the outcome. But difference is not as straightforward a word as equity. Difference, the state of being unlike, is a word without an anchor. It means dissimilar, a change, a distinguishing characteristic, a distinction. Difference makes no sense without a landmark, the special addition of a compared to. It has a fluid, decentered nature. Difference is always a word in flux, in the constant state of creation, or as cultural studies scholar Stuart Hall wrote about identity and race, a word of becoming and not simply being. Difference is, in other words, the very expression of minoritized identity. Social psychologists tell us that we know nothing neutrally. What or whom we observe is either interpreted as like us, which often produces in-group favoritism or bias, or dissimilar from us, which produces out-group negativity. UW Bothell, psychology professor and community psychologist Wadia Udell, explains, "We view the world and people in reference to our own identities, placing positive values to those whom we perceive as similar and negative values to those who are dissimilar. As difference is gauged as neither neutral nor objective, it's represented as oppositional. Thus, black gains its meaning because it is not its ostensible opposite, white. Female signifies because it is not its ostensible opposite, male. Interstitial figures, those mixed race and transgender who cannot or will not pass, and especially those who are ambiguously race or gendered, cause problems because they destroy our convenient binaries. UW history professor Ileana Rodriguez-Silva points out that such binaries are not inherent. They come from Christian Western thought and the practices of colonialism. We live in a society that is profoundly unequal and inequitable. UW sociology professor Hedwig Lee points out that race structures every moment in our lives, from our birth, our birth weights, if we are to be preterm versus full term at the time of our birth, indeed, if our infants will survive, to our death, from our life expectancy rates to the number of deaths in our population. If we embrace difference without striving for equity, we create such inequality through forces like All Lives Matter. Without equity, race can appear to be volitional. It happens through choice. It seems to be whitewashed. It springs up through a sanitized version of history where racial progress is on the continual upswing. It's individual. Racialized identity does not happen in community, and it's interchangeable, as race is not about racially specific experiences. But if we read race as difference with equity, as constituted in Black Lives Matter, we see it as ascribed, not volitional, as community, not individual, as historical and structural, not whitewashed, and even as embodied, not interchangeable. Difference, when conjoined with equity, is about access, power, and change. So now that we have those definitions under our belt, let's think about the presence of this word difference in our institution here in academia. Difference is a term that late 20th and early 21st century scholars, critics, and practitioners of race, gender, disability, and sexuality have claimed. When professors Janine Jones from the College of Education, Habiba Ibrahim from the English Department, and I got together in 2007 to form our faculty group for female professors who centered race, gender, class, and sexuality in our home and work lives, Dr. Ibrahim christened us Wired. When members of the communication department community chose the name for our new center, we invoked this term for our CCDE, the Center for Communication Difference and Equity. And when the graduate school named this series to connect with President Kausei's Race and Equity Initiative, they called it Equity and Difference. If you start to pay attention to the words, you'll notice that difference is all around us. And yet, unlike diversity, which is constantly defined and redefined in institutional context, as just about every diversity statement begins with a definition of that term, I have found that difference is assumed by scholars and critics alike to be self-evident, to speak for itself. It means more than just race, and not just diversity. But difference is left largely untheorized. We use it almost reflexively. We presume that we know what it means both to ourselves and to others. And as a race scholar, this unsettles me. So to situate difference, I'm going to look at its predecessors, tolerance, diversity, and multiculturalism. Difference replaces, or rather revises, other terms that have come to mean a deviation from a perceived norm. Where does difference lie in relation to multiculturalism, tolerance, and diversity? So first up, tolerance. Tolerance is the initial step to putting up with difference. Tolerance is not engagement, approval, acceptance, openness, or embrace. When I ask students what they tolerate, and these are their actual examples, they tell me that they tolerate a roommate clipping her toenails on the common room coffee table because they don't want to get into a fight. They tell me they tolerate filling and cheap but unhealthy packets of ramen noodles because their financial aid check has been tapped out buying textbooks. They tell me they tolerate the prying fingers of new doormates on their hair because they don't want to call out people they live day in and day out with on their racism. In other words, we always tolerate something unpleasant. We must bite our tongues and bide our time in order to remain silent about poor grooming habits, dietary compromises, and racial microaggressions. More, in tolerating the unpleasant entity, there is no impetus for whom or what we are tolerating to change, as those of us observing the distasteful behavior don't express our objections. Tolerance depends upon silence, even if the silence is silent dissent. And yet, the word tolerance has historically been upheld as progress in a social justice context. Some of our contemporary mythology about the civil rights movement was that the goal of activists was tolerance of African Americans by whites. Indeed, the phrase civil rights movement itself can be seen as one of tolerance. Historians such as UW education professor Joy Williamson Lott used the phrase black freedom struggle in lieu of the oft misunderstood and misused phrase civil rights movement, as in Williamson Lott's words, the movement was bigger than a demand for constitutional legal rights. It was about human dignity. In the black freedom struggle's fight for human dignity, it's important to note that Dr. King never used the word tolerance. King's goals were far more expansive and intrusive. He demanded a share of this country, the equity that was kept from and continues to elude African Americans. Put another way by critical race scholar Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, it's not about supplication, it's about power. It's not about asking, it's about demanding. It's not about convincing those who are currently in power, it's about changing the very face of power itself. In other words, changing racial structures of power is never about tolerance. Another predecessor to difference is multiculturalism. Multiculturalism was first used in 1950s Canada to provide a space for both French Canadian and British Canadian cultures. In the United States, multiculturalism initially grew not out of government policy, but as a bottom-up push from the Black Freedom Struggle and subsequent Pride movements. But in the university, multiculturalism has taken the strongest hold in the field of education. Christine Slater and Peter McLaren trace multicultural education to the concerns of mainly white educator activists for African-American students in the civil rights movement. Slater and McLaren describe how the term multicultural education was used rather than racism, quote, so that audiences of white educators would listen. While this tempered approach, one of not naming the truly discordant issue at hand, might have appeared to be a positive initial step, the authors write that because of the erasure of the word racism, many white educators have pulled multicultural education away from social struggles and redefined it to mean the celebration of ethnic foods and festivals. This is not to say that the word is not claimed by scholars who use multiculturalism in a resistant fashion. Education scholars at the UW uphold the area's social justice roots. Education professor Janine Jones defines multiculturalism, quote, as an inclusive construct that recognizes that with each person, coexisting cultures can interrelate and influence each other. Jones's definition, which builds on the work of her UW College of Education colleagues James Banks and Geneva Gay, draws upon students' minoritized cultures as a form of, in Jones's words, strength and renewal, a truly anti-racist move when executed in her research. For example, Jones's latest equity-focused research project uses Sisters of Nia, a cultural enrichment curriculum rooted in Afrocentric principles, in order to cultivate ethnic identity and resilience for African-American middle school girls who are fostered in white households. Foster youth have a 48% graduation rate compared to the 72% of non-foster youth in Washington State, and Jones's use of multiculturalism fights to eliminate such disparities. So while tolerance is bandied about in popular discourse and multiculturalism has its home in education departments, diversity is a term that is most used by educations of higher institution, including our own. At the university, does diversity work amount to, as education scholar Sonia Nieto writes, quote, tinkering with the edges of the system to yield few positive results, or does it disrupt, quote, the very center of power? To answer both questions, one must follow diversity to its very definition, and I will go again to our UW context. So for a number of years, if you went to the diversity portal of the University of Washington, you would see the word diversity featured in large, bold, purple font. Directly next to this word, in smaller but equally emphatic wording, comes the heart of the university's diversity mission statement. At the University of Washington, diversity is integral to excellence. We value and honor diverse experiences and perspectives, strive to create welcoming and respectful learning environments, and promote access, opportunity, and justice for all. In this proclamation, diversity is not additive or ancillary to the academic mission of the university. It's central. The active verbs value, honor, strive, and promote make the claim that the university is a dynamic, conscientious, and hardworking participant in the creation, fostering, and maintenance of diversity. Such strong statements about diversity and minoritized individuals speak back to our anti-affirmative action moment and claim a space for underrepresented minorities at the university, despite attempts at legislative hand-tying. Now, I understand diversity statements are aspirational. These are beautiful arias, unsullied by discordant equity issues. But how, in this resonant song, do we insert equity? Where do we account for the fact that our lofty goals fall in the face of our racialized realities? While the numbers of underrepresented minority undergraduates remain small, and these are a couple of years old, but not that different from today, these numbers look sizable compared to the numbers of graduate and professional students, and even more significant when looking at the demographics of the tenure and tenure track faculty. Because of the gap between aspiration and reality, some scholars are skeptical about diversity initiatives creating equity. Some, like postcolonial feminist theorist Chandra Mohanty, write of diversity as a discourse which, quote, bypasses power as well as history to suggest a harmonious, empty pluralism, unquote, an emptiness I suggest that is akin to tolerance. An instantiation of Mohanty's critique can be seen in the growing ubiquity of diversity wheels, a way to visualize the multiple aspects of our identities. In the wrong hands, taught as difference without equity, identity can be imagined as a Wheel of Fortune-style spinner where what one performs simply depends on the spin. Is it time for race? Is it time for gender? This one from the Coast Guard puts personality at the very center. There is no consideration of oppression or privilege or history or structure, as all things are weighted equally. The term difference comes next in our genealogy, but I don't want to present it as a panacea. The use of a new term in and of itself doesn't create a new song for us. In fact, because different arrives at a moment where post-racial ideologies are predominant, where, for example, last month, the black female CEO of Sam's Club was taken to task for being racist to white males because she talked about the importance of simply not having a white male leadership. In this example of racial indifference, history and power are ignored to focus solely on individuals, and individual white men pitted against this black woman. Without equity, this is indeed what difference could become. When I teach difference, I present it, like diversity, as an aspirational word. But unlike diversity, I present it as something inseparable from equity. Difference and equity create change and do not simply avoid offense. In fact, suturing difference to equity means that you might just offend. In my definition, difference embraces the qualities of connection and pride from multiculturalism, along with the realities of intersectional identities, power, and privilege. Difference with equity means these things to me because I understand it relationally. It stands on the shoulders of tolerance, multiculturalism, and diversity, and recants and revises elements of those terms. How do difference and equity operate with the buzz phrase of indifference, all lives matter? So, in this second example, I'm going to talk about how Black Lives Matter is about centering difference and equity, and All Lives Matter is about erasing both difference and equity and creating indifference in Black lives. For those of you who don't know, Black Lives Matter was founded by three Black women activists who, in the words of one of them, created a call to action for Black people after 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was posthumously placed on trial for his own murder and the killer George Zimmerman was not held accountable for the crime he committed. Black Lives Matter highlights the racialized violence made manifest through disproportionality and disparity. Black Lives Matter confronts the indifference that produces antipathy. Black Lives Matter, one of the leaders explains, is a unique contribution that goes beyond the extrajudicial killings of black people by police and vigilantes. Black Lives Matter affirms the lives of black queer and trans folks, disabled folks, black undocumented folks, folks with records, women, and all black lives along the gender spectrum. It centers those that have been marginalized within black liberation movements. It is a tactic to rebuild the black liberation movement. So I teased you with this earlier. All Lives Matter emerged as a retort to Black Lives Matter, an attempted cover-up to the very real violence against black lives recorded by cell phones, disseminated through social media, and made real to the mainstream through popular media. So I want to underscore this idea that the rallying cry, All Lives Matter, is a retort, an angry response. It's not a movement analogous to Black Lives Matter, but a silencing strategy that aims to end discussion about racialized violence. All Lives Matter gets stuck on language, having the audacity to name and claim black, which I do understand feels exclusionary to some under the aegis of a movement. It might feel like perhaps the choir won't let you take the stage with them. Let me speak to those of you struggling with this idea and also possibly aspiring to the choir by looking at some metaphors. Journalist Leonard Pitts invokes the metaphor of broken bones. If you've broken your left wrist, he questioned, how would you respond if the doctor wants to examine every bone in your body as all bones matter? Writer Jamila King's metaphor is of food. What if your family sits down to dinner and your plate is skipped? Your request to get my fair share is met by your father's response, everyone should get their fair share, and yet the platters never get passed to you. A contributor to the Daily Cost uses the metaphor of a neighbor's house catching fire. When the neighbor runs out to ask for help, another neighbor responds, why should her house get more attention than mine? I need a new roof. Another responds, look at that rude woman yelling and screaming, I'm entertaining guests. While a third says, I'm sorry, but all our houses are important. Legal scholar John A. Powell uses the metaphor of a rising tide. He says, it turns out that some folks may not have a boat, and the rising tide does not raise them up, but instead drowns them. Consider the universal goal of getting everyone out of New Orleans as the levees broke after Hurricane Katrina. The strategy was get in your vehicle and drive to safety. But as it turned out, many people, a disproportionate many of whom were African American, did not have cars. The universal strategy, safety for all, turned out not to be attainable for many. These metaphors illuminate that Black Lives Matter is not about harming non-black people, but instead attending to the very real and imminent violence faced by people of African descent in this country. It's about equity. However, through indifference, through bastardizing the logic of multiculturalism and diversity, All Lives Matter fosters such violence. All Lives Matter might pretend to be about equality, but it's actually about bolstering white privilege and tapping into old school white supremacy. A deep understanding of such disparities empowers student activists to take up the mantle of Black Lives Matter to protest not only the murders of black men and women nationwide, but also the racialized violence and injustice locally, including on their own campuses. They fight threats of violence and racial slurs while walking across campus, as at Mizzou, over social media, as at Western, or protesting black underrepresentation, as at the UW during our walkout last February. At Yale, they protest racist parodies in the form of Halloween costumes. At Georgetown and Princeton, buildings named after segregationists and enslavers. Across the country, they protest the gross underrepresentation of black students in their lecture halls and black professors in front of their classrooms. While many self-described liberal supporters are shocked and outraged at the facts of black death at the hands of police officers, support wanes when it comes to supporting protests about other registers of difference and equity, particularly those that fall in the realm of representation, such as the wearing of Halloween costumes or the naming of buildings. Those demands are posited as petty and unworthy, as all lives matter, if in content, if not in name, becomes the rallying cry. But representational demands are demands of not just difference, but equity. Consider this one example of how black murder is connected to inhuman representations of black people. When Officer Darren Wilson described Michael Brown in his grand jury testimony, he used the word demon. Wilson imaged Brown as so devoid of humanity that he narrates Brown's behavior after shooting him as, quote, almost bulking up to run through the shots, like it was making him mad that I'm shooting at him. And that face that he had was looking straight through me, like I wasn't even there. I wasn't even anything in his way. Wilson's mental image, his representation of Brown, is that he is a monster, a supervillain, not a man. Such a skewed representation in Wilson's mind helps justify his committing murder, and of course helps justify him never having to face any charges for this murder. Representations can be the very force of violence. Lionizing segregationists with enslavers with their names on buildings is a form of representational violence. Classrooms that tolerate black students but never invite them into the fold, never mentor them, as mentoring is still imagined by many as the means to bolster the future career of a little me, and never populate the pipelines for law school, medical school, PhD programs with them, is to me a form of violence. If we are to create truly anti-racist spaces, we must embrace difference and equity in not just the realm of racialized violence that comes from guns and batons, but also the racialized violence that comes from ignoring racist slurs, costumes, and naming practices. Student activists and others show us how to connect these micro and macro forces of racism under the mantle of Black Lives Matter. Our student activists not only center difference, but unapologetically suture it to equity. Students are connecting the matrix of oppression, to use the words of sociologist Patricia Hill Collins, to illuminate all of the ways in which racism infiltrates our everyday lives. Racialized violence happens through police brutalities and through brutal racial slurs. So if all lives matter amounts to indifference, and difference in equity signify a move towards change, Difference in equity might mean protesting through walkouts or hunger strikes or, and here's a plug for us here, participating in our teach-in at the ECC next Friday. Difference in equity might also mean consciously creating spaces of critique with a group of friends, which is the final portion of my talk tonight. This example comes from the last book of my new book, last chapter of my new book in progress, Screening Strategic Ambiguity, Reading Black Female Resistance to the Post-Racial Lie. So in the spring of 2009, I conducted a small audience study with 9 young women of color in their late teens and early 20s who were training to be teachers, writers, dancers, scientists, and activists. We watched a season of their favorite television show at the time, the modeling competition reality program America's Next Top Model. Our sessions illustrated the very real life ways that groups can come together to foster conscious critique, to stake a claim for themselves in a racist and sexist world, and to provide themselves with the tools to live both difference and equity. At our gatherings, the women often spoke in an easy, relaxed, and familiar manner, characteristic of what sociolinguist and UW professor of French and Italian studies Maya Angela Smith describes as, quote, a racialized narrative in which they cut each other off, spoke over each other, and repeated each other. So let me set the scene for the time period of our viewing session, the spring of 2009, and let me also let you hear some of the women's voices. This group of young women were abuzz about pop star Rihanna's brutal beating by her boyfriend and then musician Chris Brown, and the media's will she or won't she go back to him debate. They exclaimed, as Vanessa did, that there is nothing that she could have done except killed his mama to deserve to get her ass beat like that. As well as puzzled like Valentina, but I'm saying, what are you doing going back to him? Like the rest of the country, they scrutinized the media coverage of football player Michael Vick's dog fighting and called out the racialized double standard of the outrage of the killing of dogs, but not the murder of African Americans. McCall noted, the media completely turned on Vick, and Mickey agreed, adding, I know dog fighting's bad, like totally, I get it, but they treated him like he had serial murdered somebody. They commiserated about their hunger for and paucity of images of women of color in the media and shared their experience of having the excitement about Beyoncé's gracing the cover of Vogue turn to frustration when, as Camille put it, and so I'm like, okay, I'm literally buying this magazine just because Beyoncé's on the cover. But when I flipped through the magazine, there were no other people of color, and there were just like stick figures, white blonde women. All of the women were constantly on the hunt for images of women of color, and all of the women maintained a powerful critique of racialized patriarchy. Both of these desires found their home in our discussions of America's Next Top Model. While the show itself drew them in week after week, the show's host, supermodel Tyra Banks, roused their unmitigated disgust. They hate-watched her. They found Banks to be fake, a sellout, a misogynist, racially biased, and unapologetically and disproportionately cruel to women of color. For the women in my study, productive and pleasurable hate-watching fashioned not only scripts for difference and equity, but counter-scripts to indifference. The same students who carefully couched their words in class when a classmate said something that struck them as racist or sexist, i.e., they tolerated them, spoke up in bold and bawdy hate-watching critique during our screening sessions together. So let me give you an example. In assessing the excessively sexualized representations of black female characters on television, the women were concerned about the power of stereotyping influencing other viewers' ideas about black women. They lamented how a white woman exhibiting hypersexual behavior on a show is not going to bear the responsibility for all white women being stereotyped as hypersexual, but black women are. Vanessa explained, well, it's like when teenage white girls, they don't talk about the little white girl. They're going to talk about the little black girl. Like it makes black people look terrible. They're comparing us to her. Mickey concurred that their white classmates must think, we probably do splits and do booty pops. This is the term that predated twerk. Mickey's comments animated Vanessa to the conversation moved from a hypothetical description to a role play for a very real situation. Vanessa positioned herself as Mickey, responding to an imaginary white classmate choosing a first-person address. She says, I'm like, no, but I'm still black. Booty? Like, what's booty pop? Can you define booty pop? To interrupt racism, a person can feign ignorance of the controlling image and ask for elaboration. A strategy like the one Vanessa offers up forces an individual who has made a racist remark have to awkwardly define and explain use of the stereotype that might have mindlessly slipped out. In the resistance space of their viewing session, the women validated their own experiences of racism by cataloging all the stereotypes they had been asked and refuting the stereotypes by imagining themselves saying, what are you talking about? Yeah, I can't help you there, pal. And no. They repeated, I don't and I can't, which equaled refusal to participate in pretending that racism, even coded post-racial racism, didn't exist. So from this lively interaction, the women moved to a quieter, slower reflection. Jen said, it's funny, because like we're kidding, but like I've had almost all of these questions asked to me, and all the dashes denote this overlapping conversation. Mickey says, someone asked if you could booty pop. Jen says, they asked me that, and I didn't know what it was. They used a different word, but they were explaining what women do in some of the videos when they, like, lean on the car. And I was like, I don't even know why you're asking me. And it was like, no, I can't. And then the next question was, well, do black guys like that? And it was, after I just told you, I don't know how to do it, so I wouldn't know. Mickey says, well, like, I'm not a black guy. Vanessa says, you're the expert in black women and black dudes. Jen says, and then, you know, another girl came up to me one time and she put her arm around me and she goes, I'm really glad you're not one of those ghetto black girls. Like it was, Mickey interrupts, I've gotten that, Jen says, like it was a compliment. And it's kind of, you don't know, Vanessa says, what to say. Jen says, what to say right away? Like you don't know how to kind of, Mickey responds, her voice thick with sarcasm, thanks for complimenting me. While insulting me, my race, and my people? Thank you. Jen said, it's kind of, yeah, people really ask those questions. And it's not a leap to think that people, like, watch this stuff and start thinking those things. Minoritized people spend so much time questioning ourselves as to if a comment was actually offensive or if we're being hypersensitive, if we're allowed to respond or if we must remain silent. In short, if we have permission to identify racism as such. The viewing session enabled the women to say yes to all three modes of internal questioning. Hate watching and the impromptu workshop to counter everyday racism that arose bonded their women of color community in articulating the type of critique at the very heart of difference and equity. Their community functioned as the antidote to the clenched teeth survival strategy of tolerance, which flourishes alone and never in community. Because of the type of scholarship that I do, I don't claim these women to constitute a representative sample, but I also do not think that their opinions and interactions with each other are anomalous. They exemplify a slice of life that shows an unencumbered resistance to controlling images of black women in media, the type of responses that happen across living rooms, dorm couches, group texts, Facebook feeds, and Twitter streams across the world. These women's critiques, their connections, their very understanding of black womanhood was accessed just as much through their co-constitutive process of hate-watching television as it was with their engagement with each other. As they critiqued code-switching, respectability politics, colorism, tokenism, stereotyping, and the management of difference, they made sense of their own racialized and gendered lives and turned hate-watching into a space of pleasure and productivity and ultimately a space of difference and equity. So I began this talk quoting Dr. King and using the metaphor of the choir, and I want to end it quoting black feminist scholar and poet Audre Lorde and using another musical metaphor, one of polyrhythms. Lorde writes, "It's not our differences that divide us. It's our inability to recognize, accept, and celebrate those differences." In Lorde's conception, difference provides all of us, activists and scholars, members of the choir, and novice listeners with a way to build coalition. Polyrhythmic coalitions might not actually sound as coherent as a choir, but might, as UW Gender Women's Sexuality Studies professor Michelle Habel-Payan describes, be a multifaceted, pluralistic, musical conversation full of overlapping percussive moments. If some of you are now feeling ready to join the choir, maybe the beautifully discordant choir, try this. Practice, study, get some other aspiring choir members together to give each other feedback on your singing, and then begin to compose tunes together. Before you step up to the choir, begin by humming. Work up to singing. I invite those of you who aren't already singing to imagine a transformative experience it would be to hear new voices, not just our usual soloists. Let's sing, let's listen, and let's consciously create our spaces of difference and equity together. Thank you.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum. You can hear the full version of this talk on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Relina Joseph is an associate professor in UW's Department of Communication and the founding director of the Center for Communication, Difference, and Equity. She spoke at KUOW's Kane Hall on January 14th. Thanks again to Yvette Moy for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.